All right. We're in chapter 19 and chapter 20. If you want to be able to remember those, there's a couple of different ways to do it with 1 plus 9. I just said 1 plus 9, idolatry declined, because a big part of what we're going to read in chapter 19 is the impact that Paul's going to have in Ephesus on the idolatrous community, particularly in regard to Diana and the temple and some of the things that we're going to see there. And that's going to be a big part of what happens there. We will eventually get to 2.0 or 2 plus 0, which is to Jerusalem we go. And we'll see the tail end of the third journey as he takes it all the way back to Jerusalem, where that third journey is. I don't know if I'd say it ends so much as Paul gets arrested, and that pretty much ends the journey at that point. But and that'll begin the final stages of the book of Acts, which is basically Paul's trip to Rome. Just to give you a little review of where we were and where he was in the second journey, if you remember, he went through the area of Cilicia and up through Galatia, and if you remember, he takes a big right turn and goes north, because what happens when he gets to Asia? What is he told when he gets to Asia? Well, that's the second thing he's told. The man from Macedonia appears in a vision and says, come over to Macedonia and help us. Yeah, and right before that, the Spirit, in fact, two times, forbids him to go into Asia, which is that area, obviously, that we think of as Western Turkey. And so he's going to go around that, go up into Philippi and go through Macedonia and down all the way down into Achaia, which, you know, all this is the Greek region. And then he's going to spend some time in Corinth and Athens and then Corinth. And then when he comes back, we read this very briefly at the end of chapter 18. If you'll notice, he comes back by sea and stops in Ephesus, but only for a short time. And when he is there, we don't know how long he was there, but we know it was only long enough for him to go to the synagogue. He has some conversations with the church, with some of the Jews in Ephesus. Apparently that was well received, because they asked him to stay with them. But he says, no, I need to be back. I'm trying to get back back to Jerusalem. And so as a result of that, he promises to come back. He's going to come back down, and we won't read all the details, but if you remember, he's taken Aquila and Priscilla are actually with him, but they're going to stay in Ephesus. So they'll be in Ephesus this whole time while he's going to go on. And, you know, it's kind of interesting that, again, every once in a while you get details that you miss in the reading. Because when I saw this map, I thought, wait a second, this is wrong. Because in this map, it appears that the journey ends in Jerusalem. Well, they didn't go to Jerusalem. But if you look in, just so you'll know, in chapter 18, you may have a subhead that says Paul returns to Antioch. But if you'll notice what happens, it says in verse 22 that when he landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and then went down to Antioch. Now, when you read he went up and you're in Judea, typically, where are we talking about? When you go, where do you go up to in Judea? To Jerusalem, right. Most people believe, and they're probably right, that the implication here is that he went up to Jerusalem at this point. Now, that kind of makes sense when we remember that he was, in Acts 15, after the issue with the Gentile churches and trying to get some consensus and get them on the right track and make sure that the Jews understood how this was all going to work, he was then going to take this out to the Gentile churches and let them know what had been taught and making sure to confirm the gospel with them. And so it kind of makes sense that when he would get back, one of the things he would want to do is go back to Jerusalem and let the church know this has been a success. We have been back in the Gentile world. We have reconfirmed these things and all is good. And it sounds like that's probably what happened. And then, of course, when we're used to looking at maps in terms of north, south, east, and west. And so when I hear they went down to Antioch, that doesn't look right, because they go due north. But when we talk about Jerusalem, we're typically talking about going up on elevation and going back down to basically anywhere else in the region. So he makes a long circuit, comes back down to Jerusalem, and then comes back to Antioch, which is, of course, where he started this whole thing out. Both of the journeys started in that city. Now, in the third journey, you see the difference. Because now he's going to go through, as he says, he's going to go through the same cities that he was at before. He goes to Derbe, he goes to Lystra, Iconium, Antioch, and Pisidia, all places that he's been before. But now, instead of making the due right turn, he's going to go on into Asia. He now has the green light to go and teach in this region. And my suspicion is that we don't read about him going to Laodicea in the book of Acts. It appears that he did. We don't know how long he stayed, but it appeared the main point that he was trying to do was get to Ephesus. Because again, this is a place that he had visited, and this is a place that he had already said, I'm gonna come back. And if you'll notice what happens when he gets to Ephesus, let's see. Yeah, if you go down in chapter 19 and you if you look down at verse 10, it talks about what he's doing there in the city. And it says in verse 10 that this continued for 2 years so that all the residents of Asia heard the word of the Lord, both Jew and Gentile. So this is Paul spending about 2 years in Ephesus. And during that time, he's not just staying in Ephesus. Apparently, this is a time when he is going out into the surrounding areas and the surrounding cities. He may very well have visited all of these groups in the area. But we're not told. But what we do know is that because of his work and because of the work of a growing number of other disciples that are working with him, the gospel is going to continue to spread. Now, I don't know if you can read those cities up there that are in Asia, but you may notice something. Because if you go up, if you see Ephesus, which is right there in kind of in that gulf there, if you go due north, does anybody know what the first city that you get to from Ephesus is? Can you read that? Smyrna. All right. So we keep going north and we get to Pergamum. Now, if we go east, anybody want to guess where we get to? Thyatira. And then we keep going south and we get to Sardis and we get to Philadelphia and then finally down to Laodicea. I would think those names are going to sound familiar, aren't they? Those are the seven churches of Asia. And if you've ever wondered why did he pick that particular order when he wrote them, there's a pretty good chance that that's why. You may not be able to see it, but Patmos is on this map. It's right there just, it's due east of where you read Caria. There. It's right there it's not far off the coast. But most people believe that when John got this revelation and wrote this letter and he sent it off to be delivered to the churches, the first stop is the port city of Ephesus, and he just takes the road right along and goes from church to church to church and delivers this message. So it gives you a little bit just of an idea of the history of that and how, again, this ties into what we're going to read in some of the other letters. So we see the seven churches of Asia. They're all now in the process of being established, some of which may be linked to Paul, some of them may be due to other people's efforts. But regardless, the church is continuing to grow, which is, again, as we said, that's really the theme of the book of Acts, that the word of God continues to multiply and continues to grow, and souls are continuing to be added to the kingdom of God. So if we look, we talked about the idea that in Ephesus, Paul is going to be there for about 2 years. And if in chapter 19, he's there for a while. And it says in verse 21 of chapter 19, he says, after these events, and he's talking there about the sons of Sceva, and we'll talk about that certainly in a little bit. But he says, after these events, Paul resolved in the spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem. So his goal now is going to be to go up back through that region and come back down. And he, by the way, he also tells us later on that he's got some other plans involved. And in fact, if you turn over, if you keep your bookmark there and go over to Romans 15, notice what he says here in Romans 15. I think this is a really important thing for us to know, because it's going to give us some context in one of the primary topics that Paul addresses in the letters of 1 and 2 Corinthians. In Romans chapter 15, notice what he says. If you go down towards the end of the passage, it says in verse 22, this is the reason why I have so often been hindered from coming to you. Now, he's writing the book of Romans, and most people believe he wrote this when he was at Ephesus, and it's probably right around the time we're talking about now. But he tells us what his plans are. He says, but now, since I no longer have any room for work in these regions, and since I have longed for many years to come to you, I hope to see you in passing as I go to Spain, and to be helped on my journey there by you, once I have enjoyed your company for a while. At present, however, I am going down to Jerusalem, bringing aid to the saints. From Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make some contribution for the poor among the saints at Jerusalem. For they were pleased to do it, and indeed they owe it to them. For if the Gentiles had come to share in their spiritual blessings, they ought also to be of service to them in material blessings. Therefore, when I have completed this and have delivered to them what has been collected, I will leave for Spain by way of you. And I know that when I come to you, I will come in the fullness of the blessings of Christ. So Paul's writing to the church of Rome that he has never met, but they are already established. And by the way, if you read into Romans 16, do you remember who else is there? Two of Paul's other friends that are already there in Rome. Do you remember? Aquila and Priscilla. I don't know if that means that they established this church or if they built this church, but clearly they'd come back home. If you remember, they had been cast out of Rome. Now, apparently, that ban has been repealed. Apparently, the Jews were allowed to come back. And so now they, by this time, they've gone from Ephesus and are back in Rome and are clearly very active in the Lord's church there. And so the idea here is Paul saying, I'm going to go back and I'm going to bring this gift that, if you remember, Macedonia and Achaia, and when we think about the primary church in Achaia that we want to think about, when we talk about Achaia, who are we referring to? Yeah, we're referring to Corinth. That's going to be the main. There was likely a church in Athens as well, but Corinth is the main group that we read about. And he's going to go up into Macedonia, which, if you remember, we're talking about Thessalonica, we're talking about Philippi, we're talking about Berea, these multiple groups that are in this area. And he also, so he says, they've agreed, because of this peace that we have now between the Jewish church and the Gentile church, which is now one church, we've brought that division away. And these Gentiles who see the blessings that they have are now saying, we know that there are Jewish Christians in Judea that are having troubles because of a famine that is going on there. And they said, we want to help with that. And the reason that they want to help is why? What's the bond that motivates them to volunteer to do this? I'm sorry?
Their Christian love.
Their Christian love.
They're now part of the same group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They have a bond that they didn't have before. And they also recognize, I think, and Paul talks about this in the letters as well, that, you know, where did all this come from? Why did the Gentiles receive the gospel to begin with? Well, because it came from through Israel. And again, Paul spends a lot of time in the book of Romans talking about the relationship between Jew and Gentile and how that relationship is ultimately supposed to look. And this is a great example, I think, that Luke includes, and we read about in Paul's letters, that the desire is that Jew and Gentile will be one, and that they'll be one in the same way that they were one all the way back in Acts 6. If you remember, in Acts 6, there was a need. The Jews there, the Christians there, saw that there was a need, and their first response is, we want to take care of that need. And that's still, it ought to still be true today because of that bond we have in Christ. And so we see that, and we get more details in this if you go into 1 Corinthians 16. So in 1 Corinthians 16, and this is a passage we go to a lot, and it's, again, I think it's important to understand what's happening in 1 Corinthians 16 in the context of all of this. Because if you'll notice what he says, it's in 1 Corinthians 16, it's the last chapter in the book, and he says in verse 1, now concerning the collection for the saints, let's stop there. Which saints are we talking about here? The saints in Jerusalem, the saints in Judea. I think we kind of understand that. He's talking about the same work that we've been already saying. He says, for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, in other words, those groups that he's passed through on this last journey, so you also are to do, talking about Corinth. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put something aside and store it up as he may prosper, so that there will be no collections when I come. And when I arrive, I will send to those whom you accredit by letter to carry your gift to Jerusalem. If it seems advisable that I should go also, they will accompany me. For I will visit you after passing through Macedonia. For I intend to pass through Macedonia, and perhaps I will stay with you or even spend the winter so that you may help me on my journey wherever I go. And by the way, just so you'll know, you did not sail on the sea during the winter. I don't know if that's still true in the Mediterranean, but you didn't do it back then. It was dangerous, and we find that out later on when Paul ends up being shipwrecked because of this. But so he has a place that he's going to winter, and his plan is to do that in Corinth. He says, in verse 7, I do not want to see you now just in passing. I hope to spend some time with you if the Lord permits, but I will stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. For a wide door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. And we're about to find out exactly what he's talking about. In fact, I think what we see, if I understand the text correctly, is that Paul's plans are going to have to change because of what happens in Ephesus. His plan is to stay here for a lot longer than this. He's going to stay through Pentecost, which Anybody remember when Pentecost is? Not a date necessarily, but just generally what part of the calendar that's going to be? Yeah, it's the late spring. If you remember, you've got the Passover, and then 50 days later, you've got Pentecost, which is the first in gathering. So that's the very beginning of the harvest. It takes place, I believe, in this midsummer. I can't remember the exact date. But so there's the idea that he's going to be there for a while. In fact, he's planning on staying through the rest of the year, I think. And we're going to see that those things are going to come to an end. So when we understand what's going on in 1 Corinthians 16, what is the purpose in 1 Corinthians 16 for the collection here?
Needy saints.
Needy saints. When did this collection start? Well, I mean, that's when they did it, right? On the first day of every week.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the instructions are for that. This is how we're going to do it. On the first day of every week, I want you to lay by in store. And he says so that there will be no collections when I come. In other words, when we think about that from a logical standpoint, let's say that we were trying to assist somebody down in the valley or something. There maybe something came in and just destroyed their building, and they're having hardships and all kinds of stuff. And we decide that we're going to collect funds. How effective are we going to be if somebody showed up Sunday morning and said, "Hey, we need collection for the fund for the saints there. Everybody, what do you got?" We might do okay, but we're probably not going to do that well. But if he says, "I'm going to be up there in X months, and I'd like you to put aside some every week so that we're ready to go, and so that when I come here, I don't have to go house to house and hat in hand and go to the collection and say, 'Look, we need more. You'll have something amassed. In other words, there is a need. There is a need that is greater than we can just simply handle immediately. We're going to have to save and plan for this need. And of course, the implication of that is, what are we doing with the money when we store it every week? I would assume that, I think it's a pretty strong implication that they had to pool that money and store it together, right? I mean, I think that makes sense. I don't know why you would. I guess it's possible that they could have stored it in their own homes, but it seems more likely that they're going to collect whoever is authorized to hold that for the church. So we have here the authorization that if the church has a need that is approved in Scripture, that we have the right to do this work and we need funds to do it, how do we collect that money? We have a collection on the first day of the week. When we come together, we collect those funds. I've heard brethren say, and I make this point, and I guess maybe to some degree it might almost be considered a little bit of a nitpicking thing, but I think it's important to understand. There's no indication that there was a collection at Corinth on the first day of the week until Paul established that there was a need. I've heard Christians that will argue, and if you believe this, I'm glad to talk about this, but that the collection of the saints is one of the five acts of worship, and we have to have a collection every single Sunday, and if we don't have a collection, it's not a legitimate worship that has to be done. But what I think we see with Paul here in 1 Corinthians 16 is there's not a command to collect, but what there is an authorization to collect. But to collect money, what do I have to have? What is the application? Every single time we see a collection, what is the pattern? Why do we take up a collection to begin with? We have a need, right? If we don't have a need, should we have a collection? I think we'd have a hard time. Now, having said that, there's always a need, isn't there? I don't want to say, no, please don't misunderstand me that I'm saying we should stop taking up a collection, because there is always a need. We have ongoing needs that we have to fulfill, and frankly, if we're not helping somebody with the money that we have today as a society, I think we need to reevaluate ourselves. We need to be finding opportunities to do the Lord's work in some way. So there's always going to be a collection. There's always going to be a need. But I always think it's important that we understand that the need is what drives this, not the collection. And again, we'll talk about this. We won't get too much into this because I know we don't have a lot of time. But if you get into 2 Corinthians and you start seeing how that need is to be met, and we talked about this a little bit in the churches in Macedonia, the churches that were apparently not particularly well off, but they were absolutely insistent that we want to be involved in this too. We want to give to this work. And as he said, they gave beyond themselves. They gave first to the Lord and then to us. And he tells Corinth that because Corinth is a relatively affluent group. If you remember, we talked about this a little bit last Sunday. You know, these were relatively well-off people. They were used to this idea of having a patronage relationship with philosophers or artists or things like that. And they didn't really understand why Paul wouldn't allow them to have that kind of a relationship with them. And it caused problems, and he had to assure them, look, the reason I'm not taking money from you is I don't want anybody to think that I'm down here preaching the gospel so that you will support me financially. If you remember, it's been a while since we talked about this, but do you remember, which church do we know was supporting Paul throughout his ministry? Do you remember? There's one church that he mentions, and he talks about it in the letter to them. And it's in the church of Philippi. It's the Philippian church. If you remember, he talks about, at the end of the letter, He tells them, you know, he talks about how he received from them his most recent gift. It was abundant. He says, I'm content. I've got everything I need. You don't need to worry about me. I'm doing fine. And so he's receiving money and he's receiving assistance. And now he is again going around to these churches and saying, we need to also give assistance to these brethren that are down in Jerusalem. We'll stop there for a little bit. We covered a lot of things. Any comments or questions or anything I missed on that? Yes, ma'am.
Well, I was just thinking about the fact that just as we do with our own personal function, we want to try to be prepared ahead of the emergency.
Yeah.
So you want to be correcting things and be a good steward and say, well, we need to have this so that if there is a need that comes up,
yeah,
we have something already in advance to.
That is true. Yeah, I think that's right. There's the idea of being good stewards or being prepared. And being able to deal with things as they come up is what her point was. We do have to be careful. I will say this. We have to be careful that we make sure that we're not preparing so much and saving so much that when a present need comes up, when we've got people that really need, well, I don't know, we've got a roof fund, and we can't rob from the roof fund because, you know, because this person or this family or this whatever that we have an obligation to help needs help. I think sometimes it's, I've been at churches where all of a sudden, like you say, the saving up for an emergency that may never come sometimes overrides the actual need that needs to be fulfilled. And we do have to be careful about that, I think, as well. But your point is well made, and you're absolutely right. Yes, ma'am.
Good.
Yeah, it has to be. It is the only, you know, it's the one, well, the supporting of the evangelist and the help of needy saints, those are the two things that are not only patterns, but they're commands in the Lord. So those are things we need to always have in our mind. Any other comments, questions? Yes, sir.
You have to look at it as in, some people will look at it as it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at it as if you have it and you give generously because it's the right thing to do, the saying, what goes around comes around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And I think you do have to do it for the right reason. And when you go into 2 Corinthians, he talks about this a lot more in terms of their you know, the idea that you, if you sow abundantly, you'll reap abundantly. His point is not that if you give more money, you're generous, God will give you more money. The point is that you will be able to, you know, if you can supply this need, God will allow you to supply a greater need. It's never about, hey, I'll be rich. It's about, it's basically what Jesus said with the 5-talent man and the 2-talent man. You know, whoever has more will be given. You know, if you've made good use of what God has given you here, you're going to have greater opportunities to do more good and to do more work in the kingdom. And I think that's kind of how it's supposed to work. And so it's always with that aspiration that not so much that we can become the church in Laodicea where we can say, I'm rich, I've needed nothing, we've got a great building, we're doing all these wonderful things. It's about the idea of if God is blessing us more, what more can we do? You know, how much more work in the kingdom can we support? That's a great point. Any other thoughts, comments? So, as I said, that's the plan that Paul has in place. Well, back in 19, and again, we'll talk about some of these in more detail Sunday and then on Wednesday, plans change. Because it says in verse 21, as he said, after these events, Paul resolved in the spirit to pass through Macedonia. And so he sends Timothy and Erastus on, and he stays in Asia. And he says, about that time there arose no little disturbance concerning the way for a man named Demetrius, A silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with workmen in similar trades. Said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth, and you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. So now we've got a problem. If you remember, this has happened before with Paul, where Paul's teaching of the gospel is interfering with the local commerce, to the point where now they're even going to essentially start another riot and set in motion some things that's going to cause Paul, as it says in chapter 20, that after this uproar, Paul just has to leave early. In verse 1 of chapter 20, it says, Paul sent for the disciples. After encouraging them, he said farewell and departed for Macedonia. So there's something that strikes me about this. If you go back and read what Paul said when he wrote to the Romans about this upcoming, remember how he described it? I'm planning on being here because God has opened a wide door of opportunity. Well, it turned out that Paul didn't get to stay there that much longer. It turned out he didn't actually get to do it in the way that he planned to do it, but there was still a wide door of opportunity, wasn't it? It just wasn't the one that he thought it was going to be. It's a great example, I think, of even the Apostle Paul, who was being guided by the Spirit, didn't always know where things were going to go, and sometimes he was wrong in how he thought they were going to play out. But as a result of all of this, this starts a chain of events that's going to result in Paul going to Rome, not the way that he says he's going to. You know, he's planning to just go to Rome on his own. How's he going to go to Rome eventually?
Under guard.
Under guard and in chains, either figuratively or literally, one or the other. But he's going to go as a prisoner. So God has a way of saying, you're right, this is what I want you to do, but it's not going to be on your terms. It's going to be how I say it's going to be. It's a great example of how when we see how Jesus works through Paul, there's always an element of humility with him. And there's an idea that Paul is always, he's being persecuted, he's being beaten, he's being imprisoned, he's taken where he doesn't want to go, and yet God always uses that to get him exactly where he needs to be. And I think that's a very encouraging thing for us as we read it. So we'll stop there, and we'll start next week talking a little bit more specifically about Acts 19 and then into 20, and we'll go from there. So thank you all for your attention.